of an hour late to work. As he unlocked his office door, his superior, Police Inspector Harry Bryant, jug-eared and red-headed, sloppily dressed but wise-eyed and conscious of nearly everything of any importance, hailed him. "Meet me at 9:30 in Dave Holden's office." Inspector Bryant, as he spoke, flicked briefly through a clipboard of onion-skin typed sheets. "Holden," he continued as he started off, "is in Mount Zion Hospital with a laser tracked through his spine. He'll be there for a month at least, until they can get one of those new organic plastic spinal sections to take hold." "What happened?" Rick asked, chilled. The department's chief bounty hunter had been all right yesterday. At the end of the day, he had, as usual, zipped off in his hover car to his apartment in the crowded, high-prestige Knob Hill area of the city. Bryant muttered over his shoulder something about 9:30 in Dave's office and departed, leaving Rick standing alone. As he entered his own office, Rick heard the voice of his secretary, Ann Marston, behind him.
"Mr. Deckard, you know what happened to Mr. Holden? He got shot."
She followed after him into the stuffy, closed-up office and set the air-filtering unit into motion. "Yeah," he responded absently.
"It must have been one of those new, extra-clever Andes the Rosen Association is turning out," Miss Marston said. "Did you read over the company's brochure and the spec sheets? The Nexus 6 brain unit they're using now is capable of selecting within a field of 2 trillion constituents, or 10 million separate neural pathways."
She lowered her voice.
"You missed the vid call this morning. Miss Wilde told me. It came through the switchboard exactly at 9.
"A call in?" Rick asked. Miss Marston said,
"A call out by Mr. Bryant to the WPO in Russia, asking them if they would be willing to file a formal written complaint with the Rosen Association's factory representative East."
"Harry still wants the Nexus 6 brain unit withdrawn from the market?" He felt no surprise. Since the initial release of its specifications and performance charts back in August of 2020, most police agencies which dealt with escaped Andes had been protesting. "The Soviet police can't do any more than we can," he said. "Legally, the manufacturers of the Nexus 6 brain unit operated under colonial law, their parent auto factory being on Mars." "We had better just accept the new unit as a fact of life," he said. "It's always been this way, with every improved brain unit that's come along. I remember the howls of pain when the Sudermann people showed their old T-14 back in 18. Every police agency in the Western Hemisphere clamored that no test would detect its presence in an instance of illegal entry here. As a matter of fact, for a while they were right. Over 50 of the T-14 android, as he recalled, had made their way by one means or another to Earth, and had not been detected for a period in some cases up to an entire year. But then, the Voight empathy test had been devised by the Pavlov Institute working in the Soviet Union. And no T-14 android, insofar at least as was known, had managed to pass that particular test.
"Want to know what the Russian police said?" Miss Marston asked.
"I know that, too." Her freckled, orange face glowed. Rick said, "I'll find out from Harry Bryant." He felt irritable. Office gossip annoyed him because it always proved better than the truth. Seating himself at his desk, he pointedly fished about in a drawer until Miss Marston, perceiving the hint, departed. From the drawer, he produced an ancient, creased manila envelope. Leaning back, tilting his important style chair, he rummaged among the contents of the envelope until he came across what he wanted: the collected,
extant data on the Nexus 6. A moment's reading vindicated Miss Marston's statement. The Nexus 6 did have 2 trillion constituents, plus a choice within a range of 10 million possible combinations of cerebral activity. In 45/100ths of a second, an android equipped with such a brain structure could assume any one of 14 basic reaction postures. Well, no intelligence test would trap such an Andy. But then intelligence tests hadn't trapped an Andy in years, not since the primordial, crude varieties of the 1970s. The Nexus 6 android types, Rick reflected, surpassed several classes of human specials in terms of intelligence. In other words, androids equipped with the new Nexus 6 brain unit had, from a sort of rough, pragmatic, no-nonsense standpoint, evolved beyond a major, but inferior, segment of mankind. For better or worse. The servant had, in some cases, become more adroit than its master. But new scales of achievement, for example, the Voight-Kampff empathy test, had emerged as criteria by which to judge. An android, no matter how gifted as to pure intellectual capacity, could make no sense out of the fusion which took place routinely among the followers of mercerism. An experience which he, and virtually everyone else, including subnormal chicken heads, managed with no difficulty. He had wondered, as had most people at one time or another, precisely why an android bounced helplessly about when confronted by an empathy-measuring test. Empathy, evidently, existed only within the human community, whereas intelligence, to some degree, could be found throughout every phylum and order, including the arachnida. For one thing, the empathic faculty probably required an unimpaired group instinct. A solitary organism, such as a spider, would have no use for it. In fact, it would tend to abort a spider's ability to survive. It would make him conscious of the desire to live on the part of his prey. Hence, all predators, even highly developed mammals such as cats, would starve. Empathy, he once had decided, must be limited to herbivores, or anyhow omnivores who could depart from a meat diet. Because ultimately, the empathic gift blurred the boundaries between hunter and victim, between the successful and the defeated. As in the fusion with Mercer, everyone ascended together, or, when the cycle had come to an end, fell together into the trough of the tomb world. Oddly, it resembled a sort of biological insurance, but double-edged. As long as some creature experienced joy, then the condition for all other creatures included a fragment of joy. However, if any living being suffered, then for all the rest, the shadow could not be entirely cast off. A herd animal, such as man, would acquire a higher survival factor through this. An owl or a cobra would be destroyed. Evidently, the humanoid robot constituted a solitary predator. Rick liked to think of them that way. It made his job palatable. In retiring, that is, killing an Andy, he did not violate the rule of life laid down by Mercer. "You shall kill only the killers," Mercer had told them the year empathy boxes first appeared on Earth. And in Mercerism, as it evolved into a full theology, the concept of the killers had grown insidiously. In Mercerism, an absolute evil plucked at the threadbare cloak of the tottering, ascending old man, but it was never clear who or what this evil presence was. A Mercerite sensed evil without understanding it. Put another way, A Mercerite was free to locate the nebulous presence of the killers wherever he saw fit. For Rick Deckard, an escaped humanoid robot, which had killed its master, which had been equipped with an intelligence greater than that of many human beings, which had no regard for animals, which possessed no ability to feel empathic joy for another life form's success or grief at its defeat, that, for him, epitomized the killers. Thinking about animals reminded him of the ostrich he had seen in the pet store. Temporarily, he pushed away the specs on the Nexus 6 brain unit, took a pinch of Mrs. Siddons' number 3 and 4 snuff, and cogitated. Then he examined his watch, saw that he had time. He picked up his desk vidphone and said to Miss Marston, "Give me the Happy Dog Pet Shop on Sutter Street." "Yes, sir," Miss Marston said, and opened her phone book. "They can't really want that much for the ostrich," Rick said to himself. "They expect you to car trade like in the old days." "Happy Dog Pet Shop," a man's voice declared, and on Rick's vid screen a minute, happy face appeared. Animals could be heard bawling. "That ostrich you have in your display window," Rick said. He toyed with a ceramic ashtray before him on the desk. "What sort of a down payment would I need for that?" "Let's see," the animal salesman said, groping for a pen and pad of paper. "1/3 down," he figured. "May I ask, sir, if you're going to trade something in?" Guardedly, Rick said, "I haven't decided." "Let's say we put the ostrich on a 30-month contract," the salesman said, "at a low, low interest rate of 6% a month. That would make your monthly payment after a reasonable down." "You'll have to lower the price you're asking," Rick said. "Knock off $2,000 and I won't trade anything in. I'll come up with cash." Dave Holden, he reflected, is out of action. That could mean a great deal, depending on how many assignments show up during the coming month. "Sir," the animal salesman said, "our asking price is already $1,000 under book. Check your Sydney's. I'll hang on. I want you to see for yourself, sir, that our price is fair." Christ, Rick thought. They're standing firm. However, just for the heck of it, he wiggled his bent Sydney's out of his coat pocket, thumbed to ostrich, comma, male, female, old, young, sick, well, mint, used, and inspected the prices. "Mint, male, young, well," the salesman informed him. $30,000. He, too, had his Sydney's out. "We're exactly 1,000 under book. Now, your down payment..." "I'll think it over," Rick said, "and call you back." He started to hang up. "Your name, sir?" the salesman asked alertly. "Frank Merriwell," Rick said. "And your address, Mr. Merriwell? In case I'm not here when you call back." He made up an address and put the vidphone receiver back on its cradle. All that money, he thought. And yet, people buy them. Some people have that kind of money. Picking up the receiver again, he said harshly, "Give me an outside line, Miss Marston, and don't listen in on the conversation. It's confidential." He glared at her. "Yes, sir," Miss Marston said. "Go ahead and dial." She then cut herself out of the circuit, leaving him to face the outside world. He dialed, by memory, the number of the false animal shop at which he had gotten his ersatz sheep. On the small vid screen, a man dressed like a vet appeared. "Dr. McCray," the man declared. "This is Deckard. How much is an electric ostrich?"
Oh, I'd say we could fix you up for less than $800. How soon did you want delivery? We would have to make it up for you. There's not that much call for...
I'll talk to you later, Rick interrupted. Glancing at his watch, he saw that 9:30 had arrived. Goodbye. He hurriedly hung up, rose, and shortly thereafter stood before Inspector Bryant's office door. He passed by Bryant's receptionist, attractive, with waist-length braided silver hair, and then the inspector's secretary, an ancient monster from the Jurassic swamp, frozen and sly, like some archaic apparition fixated in the tomb world. Neither woman spoke to him nor he to them. Opening the inner door, he nodded to his superior, who was busy on the phone. Seating himself, he got out the specs on Nexus 6, which he had brought with him, and once more read them over as Inspector Bryant talked away. He felt depressed. And yet, logically, because of Dave's sudden disappearance from the work scene, he should be at least guardedly pleased. Chapter 4. Maybe I'm worried, Rick Deckard conjectured, that what happened to Dave will happen to me. And Andy smart enough to laser him could probably take me too. But that didn't seem to be it. I see you brought the poop sheet on that new brain unit, Inspector Bryant said, hanging up the vidphone. Rick said, yeah, I heard about it on the grapevine. How many Andes are involved and how far did Dave get? 8 to start with, Bryant said, consulting his clipboard. Dave got the first 2. And the remaining 6 are here in Northern California? As far as we know, Dave thinks so. That was him I was talking to. I have his notes. They were in his desk. He says all he knows is here. Bryant tapped the bundle of notepaper. So far, he did not seem inclined to pass the notes on to Rick. For some reason, he continued to leaf through them himself, frowning and working his tongue in and around the fringes of his mouth. I have nothing on my agenda, Rick offered. I'm ready to take over in Dave's place. Bryant said thoughtfully, Dave used the Voight Kampf altered scale in testing out the individuals he suspected. You realize, you ought to anyhow, that this test isn't specific for the new brain units. No test is. The Voight scale, altered 3 years ago by Kampf, is all we have. He paused, pondering. Dave considered it accurate. Maybe it is. But I would suggest this before you take out after these 6. Again, he tapped the pile of notes. Fly to Seattle and talk with the Rosen people. Have them supply you a representative sampling of types employing the new Nexus 6 unit. And put them through the Voight Kampf, Rick said. It sounds so easy, Bryant said, half to himself. Pardon? Bryant said, I think I'll talk to the Rosen organization myself while you're on your way. He eyed Rick then, silently. Finally, he grunted, gnawed on a fingernail, and eventually decided on what he wanted to say. I'm going to discuss with them the possibility of including several humans, as well as their new androids. But you won't know. It'll be my decision in conjunction with the manufacturers. It should be set up by the time you get there. He abruptly pointed at Rick, his face severe. This is the first time you'll be acting as senior bounty hunter. Dave knows a lot. He's got years of experience behind him. So have I, Rick said tensely. You've handled assignments devolving to you from Dave's schedule. He's always decided exactly which ones to turn over to you and which not to. But now you've got six that he intended to retire himself, one of which managed to get him first. This one. Bryant turned the notes around so that Rick could see. Max Polakoff, Bryant said. That's what it calls itself, anyhow. Assuming Dave was right. Everything is based on that assumption, this entire list. And yet the Voight Kampf altered scale has only been administered to the first three, the two Dave retired and then Polakoff. It was while Dave was administering the test. That's when Polakoff lasered him. Which proves that Dave was right, Rick said. Otherwise, he would not have been lasered. Polakoff would have no motive. You get started for Seattle, Bryant said. Don't tell them first. I'll handle it. Listen. He rose to his feet, soberly confronted Rick. When you run the Voight Kampf scale up there, if one of the humans fails to pass it, that can't happen, Rick said. One day, a few weeks ago, I talked with Dave about exactly that. He had been thinking along the same lines. I had a memo from the Soviet police, WPO itself, circulated throughout Earth plus the colonies. A group of psychiatrists in Leningrad have approached WPO with the following proposition. They want the latest and most accurate personality profile analytical tools used in determining the presence of an android. In other words, the Voight Kampf scale, applied to a carefully selected group of schizoid and schizophrenic human patients. Those specifically which reveal what's called a flattening of effect. You've heard of that? Rick said, that's specifically what the scale measures. Then you understand what they're worried about. This problem has always existed, since we first encountered androids posing as humans. The consensus of police opinion is known to you in Lurie Kampf's article written 8 years ago. Role-taking blockage in the undeteriorated schizophrenic. Kampf compared the diminished empathic faculty found in human mental patients and a superficially similar, but basically, the Leningrad psychiatrists, Bryant broke in brusquely, think that a small class of human beings could not pass the Voight Kampf scale. If you tested them in line with police work, you'd assess them as humanoid robots. You'd be wrong, but by then they'd be dead. He was silent now, waiting for Rick's answer. But these individuals, Rick said, would all be. They'd be in institutions, Bryant agreed. They couldn't conceivably function in the outside world. They certainly couldn't go undetected as advanced psychotics, unless, of course, their breakdown had come recently and suddenly, and no one had gotten around to noticing. But this could happen. 1,000,000-to-1 odds, Rick said. But he saw the point. What worried Dave, Bryant continued, is this appearance of the new Nexus 6 advanced type. The Rosen organization assured us, as you know, that a Nexus 6 could be delineated by standard profile tests. We took their word for it. Now we're forced, as we knew we would be, to determine it on our own. That's what you'll be doing in Seattle. You understand, don't you? That this could go wrong either way. If you can't pick out all the humanoid robots, then we have no reliable analytical tool and we'll never find the ones who are already escaping. If your scale factors out a human subject, identifies him as Android. Bryant beamed at him icily. It would be awkward, although no one, absolutely not the Rosen people, will make the news public. Actually, we'll be able to sit on it indefinitely. Although, of course, we'll have to inform WPO, and they, in turn, will notify Leningrad. Eventually, it'll pop out of the papes at us. But by then, we may have developed a better scale. He picked the phone up. You want to get started? Use a department car and fuel yourself at our pumps. Standing, Rick said, Can I take Dave Holden's notes with me? I want to read them along the way. Bryant said, Let's wait until you've tried out your scale in Seattle. His tone was interestingly merciless, and Rick Deckard noted it. When he landed the police department hover car on the roof of the Rosen Association building in Seattle, he found a young woman waiting for him. Black-haired and slender, wearing the new, huge, dust-filtering glasses, she approached his car, her hands deep in the pockets of her brightly striped long coat. She had, on her sharply defined small face, an expression of sullen distaste. What's the matter? Rick said as he stepped from the parked car. The girl said, obliquely, Oh, I don't know. Something about the way we got talked to on the phone. It doesn't matter. Abruptly, she held out her hand. He reflexively took it. I'm Rachel Rosen. I guess you're Mr. Deckard. This is not my idea, he said. Yes, Inspector Bryant told us that. But you're officially the San Francisco Police Department, and it doesn't believe our unit is to the public benefit. She eyed him from beneath long black lashes, probably artificial. Rick said, A humanoid robot is like any other machine. It can fluctuate between being a benefit and a hazard very rapidly. As a benefit, it's not our problem. But as a hazard, Rachel Rosen said, then you come in. Is it true, Mr. Deckard, that you're a bounty hunter? He shrugged, with reluctance, nodded. You have no difficulty viewing an android as inert, the girl said. So you can retire it, as they say. Do you have the group selected out for me? He said. I'd like to. He broke off, because all at once he had seen their animals. A powerful corporation, he realized, would of course be able to afford this. In the back of his mind, evidently, he had anticipated such a collection. It was not surprise that he felt, but more a sort of yearning. He quietly walked away from the girl toward the closest pen. Already he could smell them, the several scents of the creatures standing or sitting, or, in the case of what appeared to be a raccoon, asleep. Never in his life had he personally seen a raccoon. He knew the animal only from 3D films shown on television. For some reason, the dust had struck that species almost as hard as it had the birds, of which almost none survived now. In an automatic response, he brought out his much-thumbed Sydneys and looked up raccoon with all the sublistings. The list prices naturally appeared in italics. Like Percheron horses, none existed on the market for sale at any figure. Sydney's catalog simply listed the price at which the last transaction involving a raccoon had taken place. It was astronomical. His name is Bill, the girl said from behind him. Bill the raccoon. We acquired him just last year from a subsidiary corporation. She pointed past him, and he then perceived the armed company guards standing with their machine guns, the rapid-fire little light Skoda issue. The eyes of the guards had been fastened on him since his car landed. And, he thought, my car is clearly marked as a police vehicle. A major manufacturer of androids, he said thoughtfully, invests its surplus capital on living animals. Look at the owl, Rachel Rosen said. Here, I'll wake it up for you. She started toward a small, distant cage, in the center of which jutted up a branching dead tree. There are no owls, he started to say. Or so we've been told. Sydney's, he thought. They listed in their catalog as extinct. The tiny, precise type, the E, again and again throughout the catalog. As the girl walked ahead of him, he checked to see, and he was right. Sydney's never makes a mistake, he said to himself. We know that, too. What else can we depend on? It's artificial, he said, with sudden realization. His disappointment welled up keen and intense. No. She smiled, and he saw that she had small, even teeth, as white as her eyes and hair were black. But Sydney's listing, he said, trying to show her the catalog, to prove it to her. The girl said, we don't buy from Sydney's or from any animal dealer. All our purchases are from private parties, and the prices we pay aren't reported. She added, also we have our own naturalists. They're now working up in Canada. There's still a good deal of forest left, comparatively speaking, anyhow. Enough for small animals, and once in a while a bird. For a long time, he stood gazing at the owl, who dozed on its perch. A thousand thoughts came into his mind. Thoughts about the war. About the days when owls had fallen from the sky. He remembered how in his childhood it had been discovered that species upon species had become extinct, and how the papes had reported it each day. Foxes one morning, badgers the next, until people had stopped reading the perpetual animal obits. He thought, too, about his need for a real animal. Within him, an actual hatred once more manifested itself toward his electric sheep, which he had to tend, had to care about as if it lived. The tyranny of an object, he thought. It doesn't know I exist. Like the androids, it had no ability to appreciate the existence of another. He had never thought of this before, the similarity between an electric animal and an Andy. The electric animal, he pondered, could be considered a subform of the other, a kind of vastly inferior robot. Or, conversely, the android could be regarded as a highly developed, evolved version of the ersatz animal. Both viewpoints repelled him. If you sold your owl, he said to the girl, Rachel Rosen, how much would you want for it? And how much of that down? We would never sell our owl. She scrutinized him with a mixture of pleasure and pity. Or so he read her expression. And even if we sold it, you couldn't possibly pay the price. What kind of animal do you have at home? A sheep, he said. A black-faced Suffolk ewe. Well, then you should be happy. I'm happy, he answered. It's just that I always wanted an owl. Even back before they all dropped dead. He corrected himself. All but yours. Rachel said, Our present crash program and overall planning call for us to obtain an additional owl which can mate with Scrappy. She indicated the owl dozing on its perch. It had briefly opened both eyes, yellow slits which healed over as the owl settled back down to resume its slumber. Its chest rose conspicuously and fell, as if the owl, in its hypnagogic state, had sighed. Breaking away from the sight, it made absolute bitterness blend throughout his prior reaction of awe and yearning. He said, "I'd like to test out the selection now. Can we go downstairs?" "My uncle took the call from your superior, and by now he probably has..." "You're a family?" Rick broke in. "A corporation this large is a family affair?" Continuing her sentence, Rachel said, "Uncle Eldon should have an android group and a control group set up by now. So let's go." She strode toward the elevator, hands again thrust violently in the pockets of her coat. She did not look back, and he hesitated for a moment, feeling annoyance before he at last trailed after her. "What have you got against me?" he asked her as together they descended. She reflected, as if up to now she hadn't known. "Well," she said, "you, a little police department employee, are in a unique position. Know what I mean?" She gave him a malice-filled sidelong glance. "How much of your current output," he asked, "consists of types equipped with the Nexus 6?
"All," Rachel said.
"I'm sure the Voight Kampf scale will work with them."
"And if it doesn't, we'll have to withdraw all Nexus 6 types from the market."
Her black eyes flamed up. She glowered at him as the elevator ceased descending and its doors slid back. "Because you police departments can't do an adequate job in the simple matter of detecting the minuscule number of Nexus 6s who balk." A man, dapper and lean and elderly, approached them, hand extended. On his face, a harried expression showed, as if everything recently had begun happening too fast.
"I'm Eldon Rosen," he explained to Rick as they shook hands. "Listen, Deckard, you realize we don't manufacture anything here on Earth, right? We can't just phone down to production and ask for a diverse flock of items. It's not that we don't want or intend to cooperate with you. Anyhow, I've done the best I can."
His left hand, shakily, roved through his thinning hair. Indicating his department briefcase, Rick said, "I'm ready to start." The senior Rosen's nervousness buoyed up his own confidence. "They're afraid of me," he realized with a start. "Rachel Rosen included. I can probably force them to abandon manufacture of their Nexus 6 types. What I do during the next hour will affect the structure of their operation. It could conceivably determine the future of the Rosen Association, here in the United States, in Russia, and on Mars." The two members of the Rosen family studied him apprehensively, and he felt the hollowness of their manner. By coming here, he had brought the void to them, had ushered in emptiness and the hush of economic death. "They control inordinate power," he thought. "This enterprise is considered one of the system's industrial pivots. The manufacture of androids, in fact, has become so linked to the colonization effort that if one dropped into ruin, so would the other in time." The Rosen Association, naturally, understood this perfectly. Eldon Rosen had obviously been conscious of it since Harry Bryant's call. "I wouldn't worry if I were you,"
Rick said as the two Rosens led him down a highly illuminated wide corridor. He himself felt quietly content. This moment, more than any other which he could remember, pleased him. Well, they would all soon know what his testing apparatus could accomplish and could not. If you have no confidence in the Voight-Kampff scale, he pointed out, possibly your organization should have researched an alternate test. It can be argued that the responsibility rests partly on you. Oh, thanks. The Rosens had steered him from the corridor and into a chic, living roomish cubicle furnished with carpeting, lamps, couch, and modern little end tables on which rested recent magazines, including, he noticed, the February supplement to the Sydney's catalog, which he personally had not seen. In fact, the February supplement wouldn't be out for another 3 days. Obviously, the Rosen Association had a special relationship with Sydney's. Annoyed, he picked up the supplement. This is a violation of public trust. Nobody should get advance news of price changes. As a matter of fact, this might violate a federal statute. He tried to remember the relevant law, found he could not. I'm taking this with me, he said, and opening his briefcase, dropped the supplement within. After an interval of silence, Eldon Rosen said wearily, Look, officer, it hasn't been our policy to solicit advance. I'm not a peace officer, Rick said. I'm a bounty hunter. From his opened briefcase, he fished out the Voight-Kampff apparatus, seated himself at a nearby rosewood coffee table, and began to assemble the rather simple polygraphic instruments. You may send the first testee in, he informed Eldon Rosen, who now looked more haggard than ever. I'd like to watch, Rachel said, also seating herself. I've never seen an empathy test being administered. What do those things you have there measure? Rick said, This. He held up the flat adhesive disc with its trailing wires. Measures capillary dilation in the facial area. We know this to be a primary autonomic response, the so-called shame or blushing reaction to a morally shocking stimulus. It can't be controlled voluntarily, as can skin conductivity, respiration, and cardiac rate. He showed her the other instrument, a pencil beam light. This records fluctuations of tension within the eye muscles. Simultaneous with the blush phenomenon, there generally can be found a small but detectable movement of, and these can't be found in androids, Rachel said. They're not engendered by the stimuli questions, no. Although biologically they exist. Potentially. Rachel said, Give me the test. Why? Rick said, puzzled. Speaking up, Eldon Rosen said hoarsely, We selected her as your first subject. She may be an android. We're hoping you can tell. He seated himself in a series of clumsy motions, got out a cigarette, lit it, and fixedly watched. Chapter 5. The small beam of white light shone steadily into the left eye of Rachel Rosen, and against her cheek the wire mesh disc adhered. She seemed calm. Seated where he could catch the readings on the two gauges of the Voight-Kampff testing apparatus, Rick Deckard said, I'm going to outline a number of social situations. You are to express your reaction to each as quickly as possible. You will be timed, of course. And of course, Rachel said distantly, my verbal responses won't count. It's solely the eye muscle and capillary reaction that you'll use as indices. But I'll answer. I want to go through this and... She broke off. Go ahead, Mr. Deckard.
Rick, selecting question 3, said, You were given a calfskin wallet on your birthday. Both gauges immediately registered past the green and onto the red. The needles swung violently and then subsided.
I wouldn't accept it, Rachel said. Also, I'd report the person who gave it to me to the police.
After making a jot of notation, Rick continued, turning to the 8th question of the Voight-Kampff profile scale. You have a little boy, and he shows you his butterfly collection, including his killing jar.
I'd take him to the doctor.
Rachel's voice was low but firm. Again, the twin gauges registered, but this time not so far. He made a note of that, too. You're sitting watching TV, he continued, and suddenly you discover a wasp crawling on your wrist. Rachel said,
I'd kill it.
The gauges this time registered almost nothing, only a feeble and momentary tremor. He noted that and hunted cautiously for the next question. In a magazine, you come across a full-page color picture of a nude girl. He paused.
Is this testing whether I'm an android? Rachel asked tartly, or whether I'm homosexual.
The gauges did not register. He continued, Your husband likes the picture. Still, the gauges failed to indicate a reaction. The girl, he added, is lying face down on a large and beautiful bearskin rug. The gauges remained inert, and he said to himself, an android response. Failing to detect the major element, the dead animal pelt. Her, its mind is concentrating on other factors. Your husband hangs the picture up on the wall of his study, he finished, and this time the needles moved.
I certainly wouldn't let him, Rachel said.
Okay, he said, nodding. Now consider this. You're reading a novel written in the old days before the war. The characters are visiting Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. They become hungry and enter a seafood restaurant. One of them orders lobster, and the chef drops the lobster into the tub of boiling water while the characters watch.
Oh, God, Rachel said. That's awful. Did they really do that? It's depraved. You mean a live lobster?
The gauges, however, did not respond. Formally, a correct response. But simulated. You rent a mountain cabin, he said, in an area still verdant. It's rustic, knotty pine with a huge fireplace.
Yes, Rachel said, nodding impatiently.
On the walls, someone has hung old maps, Currier and Ives prints, and above the fireplace, a deer's head has been mounted, a full stag with developed horns. The people with you admire the decor of the cabin, and you all decide
not with the deer head, Rachel said.
The gauges, however, showed an amplitude within the green only. You become pregnant, Rick continued, by a man who has promised to marry you. The man goes off with another woman, your best friend. You get an abortion and...
I would never get an abortion, Rachel said. Anyhow, you can't. It's a life sentence and the police are always watching.
This time both needles swung violently into the red. How do you know that? Rick asked her, curiously. About the difficulty of obtaining an abortion.
Everybody knows that, Rachel answered.
It sounded like you spoke from personal experience. He watched the needles intently.
they still swept out a wide path across the dials.
One more. You're dating a man and he asks you to visit his apartment. While you're there, he offers you a drink. As you stand holding your glass, you see into the bedroom. It's attractively decorated with bullfight posters, and you wander in to look closer. He follows after you, closing the door. Putting his arm around you, he says, Rachel interrupted, "What's a bullfight poster?"
"Drawings, usually in color and very large, showing a matador with his cape, a bull trying to gore him."
He was puzzled.
"How old are you?" he asked. That might be a factor.
"I'm 18, Rachel said. "Okay, so this man closes the door and puts his arm around me. What does he say?"
Rick said, "Do you know how bullfights ended?"
"I suppose somebody got hurt."
"The bull at the end was always killed." He waited, watching the two needles. They palpitated restlessly, nothing more. No real reading at all. "A final question," he said. "Two-part. You were watching an old movie on TV, a movie from before the war. It shows a banquet in progress. The guests are enjoying raw oysters."
"Ugh," Rachel said. The needles swung swiftly.
"The entree," he continued, "consists of boiled dog stuffed with rice." The needles moved less this time, less than they had for the raw oysters. "Are raw oysters more acceptable to you than a dish of boiled dog?"
"Evidently not."
He put his pencil down, shut off the beam of light, removed the adhesive patch from her cheek. "You're an android," he said. That's the conclusion of the testing, he informed her, or rather it, and Eldon Rosen, who regarded him with writhing worry. The elderly man's face contorted, shifted plastically with angry concern.
"I'm right, aren't I?" Rick said.
There was no answer from either of the Rosens. "Look," he said reasonably, "we have no conflict of interest. It's important to me that the Voight-Kampff test functions, almost as important as it is to you." The elder Rosen said,
"She's not an android."
"I don't believe it," Rick said.
"Why would he lie?" Rachel said to Rick fiercely. "If anything, we'd lie the other way."
"I want a bone marrow analysis made of you," Rick said to her. "It can eventually be organically determined whether you're android or not. It's slow and painful, admittedly, but
legally," Rachel said,
"I can't be forced to undergo a bone marrow test. That's been established in the courts, self-incrimination. And anyhow, on a live person, not the corpse of a retired android, it takes a long time. You can give that damn Voight-Kampff profile test because of the specials. They have to be tested for constantly, and while the government was doing that, you police agencies slipped the Voight-Kampff through. But what you said is true. That's the end of the testing." She rose to her feet, paced away from him, and stood with her hands on her hips, her back to him.
"The issue is not the legality of the bone marrow analysis," Eldon Rosen said huskily.
"The issue is that your empathy delineation test failed in response to my niece. I can explain why she scored as an android might. Rachel grew up aboard Salander 3. She was born on it. She spent 14 of her 18 years living off its tape library and what the 9 other crew members, all adults, knew about Earth. Then, as you know, the ship turned back a sixth of the way to Proxima.
Otherwise, Rachel would never have seen Earth. Anyhow, not until her later life.
You would have retired me, Rachel said over her shoulder. In a police dragnet, I would have been killed.
I've known that since I got here 4 years ago. This isn't the first time the Voight-Kampff test has been given to me. In fact, I rarely leave this building. The risk is enormous because of those roadblocks you police set up, those flying wedge spot checks to pick up unclassified specials.
And androids, Elden Rosen added. Although naturally, the public isn't told that. They're not supposed to know that androids are on Earth, in our midst.
I don't think they are, Rick said. I think the various police agencies here and in the Soviet Union have gotten them all. The population is small enough now. Everyone, sooner or later, runs into a random checkpoint. That, anyhow, was the idea.
What were your instructions? Elden Rosen asked. If you wound up designating a human as android?
That's a departmental matter. He began restoring his testing gear to his briefcase. The two Rosens watched silently. Obviously, he added, I was told to cancel further testing, as I'm now doing. If it failed once, there's no point in going on. He snapped the briefcase shut.
We could have defrauded you, Rachel said.
Nothing forced us to admit you mistested me. And the same for the other 9 subjects we've selected. She gestured vigorously. All we had to do was simply go along with your test results, either way. Rick said, I would have insisted on a list in advance. A sealed envelope breakdown. And compared my own test results for congruity. There would have had to be congruity. And I can see now, he realized, that I wouldn't have gotten it. Bryant was right. Thank God I didn't go out bounty hunting on the basis of this test.
Yes, I suppose you would have done that, Elden Rosen said.
He glanced at Rachel, who nodded.
We discussed that possibility, Elden said then with reluctance.
This problem, Rick said, stems entirely from your method of operation, Mr. Rosen. Nobody forced your organization to evolve the production of humanoid robots to a point where
we produced what the colonists wanted, Elden Rosen said.
We followed the time-honored principle underlying every commercial venture. If our firm hadn't made these progressively more human types, other firms in the field would have. We knew the risk we were taking when we developed the Nexus 6 brain unit. But your Voight-Kampff test was a failure before we released that type of android. If you had failed to classify a Nexus 6 android as an android, if you had checked it out as human, but that's not what happened.
His voice had become hard and bitingly penetrating.
Your police department, others as well, may have retired, very probably have retired, authentic humans with underdeveloped empathic ability, such as my innocent niece here. Your position, Mr. Deckard, is extremely bad morally. Ours isn't.
In other words, Rick said with acuity, I'm not going to be given a chance to check out a single Nexus 6. You people dropped this schizoid girl on me beforehand. And my test, he realized, is wiped out. I shouldn't have gone for it, he said to himself. However, it's too late now.
We have you, Mr. Deckard, Rachel Rosen agreed in a quiet, reasonable voice.
She turned toward him then and smiled. He could not make out, even now, how the Rosen Association had managed to snare him, and so easily. Experts, he realized. A mammoth corporation like this, it embodies too much experience. It possesses, in fact,